Okay. There are no crafts tonight because in order to get to medicine, I mean, I don't know if we'll get to it towards the end, but in order to get to it, we have to sort of address a very sticky subject in Jewish law and in the application of Jewish law. And it really comes to a head in this class particularly, in this topic particularly, which is the topic of taking medicine on Shabbos. Okay, as long as you can't see me, that's okay. So, it's a very interesting topic and a very involved one. Taking medicine is, I think I've been avoiding it. I've been pushing them off because I think you guys asked me at the very beginning for the medicine class. Because it's more complicated than it seems. And it's much more involved, and there's different levels and layers that we're going to get to as time goes along. But even before we get there, we have to talk about what is the problem taking medicine on Shabbos in the first place. Why in the world wouldn't a person be allowed to take medicine on Shabbos?
It's a reasonable question.
Right. Talk to a doctor. Well, a doctor is very easy. Meaning you and your practice, what you do, there are a ton of things that you do that are violations of the Shabbos.
That's good.
Making a wound,
yeah.
Right? That's a violation of the Shabbos, for example. Tying a bandage, for example. There are just any number of things that a doctor could do that would be a violation of Shabbos. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to taking medicines, per se, what would be the problem of taking medicine on Shabbos? Can't come up with anything, right? What malacha would you possibly do that would prohibit one from taking medicine on Shabbos?
In the past, to make it.
Oh, in the past. Let's see. Right. Grinding. Absolutely correct. And that's, I think I mentioned this last week, that it's based on the malacha of tochin, of grinding, as we'll soon see. So let's look on your sources, which is page one, take your medicine. Okay? And let's see what's going on. So it says the Gemara, Tashma, come in here. It's in the middle of a different discussion. But this is the basis for not only taking medicines, but doing actions that benefit a person's health. Says the Mishnah, Tashma, Behema she'achaza dam, an animal, she'achaza dam, who has been grabbed by blood. So it has some sort of ailment of the blood, and it seems that it has a high temperature. Okay? Ein ma'amidin osa b'mayim b'shvil she'tichnane. One is not permitted to take this animal and put it in the water so that it should cool off. You need to cool it off by letting it soak in the water. You need this one. Okay? There's only one right now. So the Gemara says, Adam, but a person, she'achaz adam, who has the same ailment, ma'amidin osa b'mayim b'shvil she'itzdanim. A person can put that, can, if I want to soak in water, I'm allowed to do that. So, Amar Ula, why? Gzeira mishum shchichat simamnim. That's a gzeira, a decree. Mishum, because of shchichat simamnim, means the crushing of medicines. Okay? So, what do we learn from here? It's important to derive from here. What do we learn from here?
What is more important than animals?
Well, people are definitely more important than animals. It's not a matter of more important or not. What is getting in the water? What is putting your animal in the water have anything to do with crushing medicine? Anyone? None? Let's look at Rashi. Rashi says, Gizera Mishum Shechigak Simamnim. Okay. Says Rashi, Bemide de Refuah. In issues of or actions of Refuah, of healing, Gazi Rabbana, the rabbis made a decree. The Isaris Sum Refuah, the language is very important. If we permitted any refuah, any acts of healing, after the Mishrei Shechikak Shimamnim, they would come to permit the grinding of medicines. V'hu isur d'oraita d'have tochen. And the grinding of medicines is a d'oraita prohibition, which is tochen, which is the d'oraita of grinding. So preparing of medicines was absolutely forbidden. And the rabbis felt, apparently very, very strongly, that if one was permitted to do any actions of refuah, of healing, then that would lead to the grinding of medicines in general. And the rabbis have the ability to make a gzera, to make a decree, to prevent one from doing such a thing.
Okay, but who grinds chemicals today?
Well, I'm going to get to that.
What about life and death?
I can remember a pharmacist who used to
compound
when I was a kid.
Yeah.
A long time.
Can you?
Oh,
yeah. Me too.
Used to grind, used to mix his own panic powder. And remember, he was the father of a good friend of mine.
Right.
could put it in some caffeine in it, and he says, because if it doesn't taste bitter, it doesn't cure the headache.
Really? Now, did it work? Did it work?
I don't know.
It's interesting. I often wonder, you know, a pharmacist has to go to pharmacy, you have to go to pharmacy school for like 3 years, right? So, 5 years? Why?
It's basically now it's six. It used to be 5 years.
6 years?
Now they make you go back to get a 5 year.
For what? I never really understood it because it just seems to me. Is she a pharmacist?
She was a pharmacist. She's a pharmacist.
It just seems to be, now I can say what I was going to say. It seems to be that it's just, they just count the pills.
No.
And compounding pharmacy is different.
What do they do at the pharmacy when I'm not looking?
First of all, you know, the big part of it is knowing what you're taking vis-a-vis what else is out there, making sure that it's...
See, but when I go to the pharmacist, I call it in. I go to Walgreens. They never talk to me.
Yeah.
They don't know what I have. They never talk to my doctor. They fill it. I pick it up in the drive-thru.
Yeah,
does anybody not have that experience when they pick up fire?
You never had to fill out a form of all the medications. It's all computerized.
It's all computerized,
what
right.
Taking, and they can
but they have to know
list.
What you're taking.
They don't know what else I'm taking. I could go to
you
another pharmacy.
To read that and not give you the wrong
prescriptions in that computer.
In that computer. What if I go to another drugstore for a different one? What if I'm Rush Limbaugh and I go to five different doctors? I'm sure it is. I'm sure they know a ton, but it must be very frustrating to get out in the field and be...
I think it's easier than it used to be.
Yeah.
David's father was a pharmacist.
I know the one that works at the hospital, and they have a lot of...
Yeah, I think it's easier than it
okay,
used to be.
Okay, fine, I'll accept that. Yeah. The hospital, they have
they
to know the patient.
A lot. I mean,
right.
They tell, you know, this drug and this drug, if you haven't found out, it makes an interaction, so they're just warning us. So.
You have to, at least according to my wife,
okay.
The biggest part is making sure by eating different times you get the right thing.
And
right.
Compounding
yeah.
pharmacies.
Can I ask you a question?
What is the redundancy? So Gene asked a question.
No. My problem with what you're saying is why couldn't they just say you can't grind medicine, but
right.
you can do these other things.
Well,
I and then it would be in black and white. And I wouldn't think, oh, I can do this. I couldn't grind medicine because I would see it in black and white. Mm-hmm. I can't do that part of it. I can do this part, but I can't do that part.
All over the Torah.
Why they get, I know. Why they get a sweeping generalization?
Obviously, in this area, sometimes the Gzera is more specific. It's a good question. And sometimes the Gzera is more general. So I mean, it all depends, probably, on what the rabbis were seeing.
Well, where does Pikuach Nefesh come in?
Oh, I'm not going to get to that even today. Okay? we will get to that today, just very, very generally. Okay? But we're talking about healing not in life-saving matters. Okay? And we'll get to the Pikuach Nefesh in a second. Pikuach Nefesh means someone's life is in danger. And we'll talk about that. The rabbis had the discretion to make decrees in areas which they felt one thing would lead to another. And I think that if you look through the Gemara and you look through all the examples, they were very, very astutely aware of human nature. One thing that you can't say is that they were not aware of human nature. You know, I'll give you just a really good example. Okay, they say Shlomo HaMelech, but he was acting as one of the Rabbanan. He was goes there. He decreed that a certain behavior is prohibited. Anybody want to tell me? Any teachers in the room of adolescents? It's called Negiah. What is Negiah? Negiah is
touching.
Any contact between males and females who are not actually married to each other or directly related to one another. So now in today's day and age, everybody says, wow, that's unbelievably extreme. Right? How could it be? It's really, you're shaking your head, no, it's not extreme. The answer is because the rabbis understood human nature. And they understood the power that the human touch has, and they can't just say, you can't do this. Because it doesn't work that way. Human nature is not such. They understood that if you could do everything but that, and all of a sudden, you know, then there's no way to legislate that. You know, you can't control it.
There's one extensive thing I don't understand. Okay, the Gia is forbidden if you're not married to the girl, or there's no...
Actually, it's forbidden even if you are married to the girl.
What?
It's forbidden if you are married to the girl, too, you know. The Gia is forbidden to either someone who's not a direct relative, mother, daughter, grandmother, etc.,
mm-hmm.
or someone who you're not allowed to, or someone who you're allowed to have intimate relations with.
Mm-hmm.
So when a person's wife is in a state of nida,
right.
You can't. There's no Negiah for that either.
I was told the story of a kid who was stopped by his Rebbe walking down the street holding hands with a girl.
Yeah.
He said, "But this is my sister, my twin sister."
How old were they?
15, 12.
Okay.
All right. Now, wouldn't that lead to incest?
What do you mean?
He's touching his sister.
Correct.
It's an incestuous relationship that's carried out.
Correct.
But the Rebbe said it's okay. I didn't know it was your sister.
Oh, the Rebbe allowed if it was your sister?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I don't want to get into the vagaries of Hilchos Nida today, but and the Giyah. But anyway, that's just an example. And I think that the rabbis, I believe that the rabbis had a very keen awareness of what human nature was. And if they permitted one thing, then that would lead to another thing. I was just talking to someone today, you have to be able to see, not 5 years down the road, not 10 years down the road, but 50 or 100 or 500 years down the road. What will come out if we allow this? If we allow everything but, where do you draw the line? And sometimes you have to draw the line at really almost nothing. Because they saw that if they drew the line any farther, what is it going to lead to? Chaos and mayhem. So for example, somebody was in my office today, Mark, you have to apologize to me. We were talking about the demise religiously of the conservative movement. And it all started with them saying that you could drive to shul on Shabbos, but they said only for the purpose of going to shul. That's what they said, specifically. It's the civil slope. I mean, everybody will acknowledge today, from me all the way to the president of the Jewish Theological Seminary, that that was a slippery slope that began the demise of the conservative movement as a movement. So how come? Because they didn't see 5 years down the road it was the same, 10 years it was okay, 20 years maybe it was okay, but 50 years later, well, if this is okay, then that's okay. If this is okay, then that's okay. And who knows what's going to be in another 50 years. So sometimes the rabbis felt, and I think justifiably so, it seems a little extreme, I guess. Yeah, right. It does seem extreme, but I think they must have felt that extreme was justified in this case in order to protect from a person violating the Shabbos. Giving another example where the rabbi seemed to enact something that's extreme in order to prevent you from violating the Shabbos. Another example.
Prohibition of playing musical instruments.
Yeah.
I understand it, and I'm having a story for it, but wasn't it that let's say you're playing your guitar,
yeah,
and the string breaks.
Correct.
You counted to 60.
Instinctively you would fix it.
Yeah,
well, let me give you another one. Do you think that's extreme?
Depending on how you look at it.
Okay, let me ask you this. You start playing your guitar. What's the first thing any good guitar player does? You got it. So now, is that extreme? You're not allowed to tune the guitar either.
No, because you're...
You can't play without tuning it first.
So you're not going to play it. You're going to be tempted to do it.
You are certainly going to be tempted to do it because you can't play without that. So, you know, give me another example. The rabbis did something really extreme in order to live a long day.
Moksa.
What?
Moksa.
Moksa seems extreme, but it's even more extreme than that. It happened this year.
This year?
It happened this year.
Is that kind of this year?
Yeah. It applied this year. We did not blow the shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah.
Because it's blowing the shofars.
Right. Mm-hmm. Why? We didn't blow the shofar.
Because
you might carry a shofar on Shabbos. In fact, not only that, what else didn't we do? We didn't take a little of an esrog.
That's right.
On the first day. And it happens to be that the only day that it's Yol Raisa, that's the Mitzvah Yol Raisa, to shake the little of an esrog in Oak Park, Michigan, is the first day of Sukkot. So the rabbi said, we'd rather no Jews shake a little of an esrog, as opposed to the fact that somebody might carry on Shabbos.
Except in the Beit Midrash or before the
Sanhedrin. Right, they were permitted in those specific cases. They were not gozer in those cases. And I don't want to go into that either. But again, the rabbis felt, and I think strongly so, that you wonder why. Why do we focus so much on Shabbos? Why is Shabbos so much a cornerstone of the Jewish religion? Why? Because it isn't just because the Torah says keep Shabbos. It's because the rabbis made these takanos like muktzah and like all of these things, this one, in order to safeguard the Shabbos, and these things highlight just how important the Shabbos is.
Reading Megillah on Shabbos.
Again, reading Megillah on Shabbos, all those things. Right, that's not even the Darabana. I'm giving you examples of the Oraisa. You know, it's so interesting. People think that it's just a bunch of rules. Like, Gemara is a bunch of rules. But it's not a bunch of rules. The rules also form a worldview, a hashkafa. You know, and you know, people very often, especially people who are somewhat learned, will look into a specific thing and say, oh, it says I can do this and this and this and this. But to really be a posek, to really be someone who knows how to decide halacha, you have to have the broad picture. You have to not only know the specific issue, but have the general worldview also. And very often, very, very often, you find people are advocates on a certain issue, on one specific issue. Oh, I see that it says that, without really seeing the larger picture. Okay, so let's see how this all played out. So let's go, we'll skip all the way to Shulchan Aruch. That's Shin Kaf Chet. Yin Chol B'Shabbos. Mi Shiyesho Mechus B'Alma. Nechosh bi'alma means someone who has a slight pain, a level of pain. Mm-hmm. And we're going to define what that is. Okay? But he can walk around like he's healthy. He's healthy. He's generally healthy other than this mechosh bi'alma, than this feeling. Asur la'asos lo shum refuah. He is not permitted to do anything medicinal whatsoever. V'afilu al yidei eino Yehudi. Even though it's done, even if you wanted to do it through a non-Jew, you wanted to ask a non-Jew to do it, it's not permitted. Why? Gzeira mishru m'shechikat simamnim. It is a gzeira, a decree, because of the grinding of medicines. Now, just so happened in the time of the Rabbi Yosef Karo, this was very relevant. The grinding of medicines was relevant. Okay, so let's look at the Mishnah Berura. Nechosh ba'alma, okay, de'im ka'iv le'tuva, if it hurts him a lot, v'chala kol gufo al yedeze oshenafal l'mishkav. Okay, it's very important to read these categories, okay? What is nechosh ba'alma? Okay, this is not what it's not. If it hurts a lot, so that, A, see the second line, chala kol gufo, either you have a whole body pain, or shenafal lemishkav, or you have to lie down. Then af she'ein bo sakana, even though you're not in danger, mutar laso bishvilo refuah she'ein b'malacha. Then refuah was permitted. So the rabbis, they were gozer, they decreed against refuah in the following case, where you're not what's called a chole she'ein bo sakana, a chole who is not sick.
What does refuah she'ein b'malacha mean?
Well, a refuah that doesn't involve doing a malacha, doing a Shabbos malacha, like, for example, grinding. Like
grinding.
Okay, well, that you wouldn't be permitted to do. But what could you do?
Put cold water.
Cold water. Take a medicine. A massage. Right. You're absolutely right. Or taking medicine, for example, taking a pill. Okay. And as we're going to see, as the level of sickness goes up, the level of permissibility also goes up. It's a sliding scale. So, but here we have what is nechosh ba'alma. Nechosh ba'alma generally is someone who has a pain, but it doesn't apply to his whole body, or he doesn't have to lie down. Right. Meaning,
localized pain.
What?
Localized pain.
Localized pain. Localized pain that would not make you lie down. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the Shulchan Aruch writes, in that case, one would not be permitted, in that case, to do any refuah at all. Anything that would alleviate the pain at all.
Even a massage.
Even a massage, like a therapeutic massage. A light massage, you could. Because that's something that normally would be done. But a therapeutic massage, let's say you had deep muscle pain, and your wife was a physical therapist.
Okay.
Right? And she wanted to work you over. That would not be permitted on Shabbos. Mm-hmm. Even though there's no malacha whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the rabbis were gozer, they decreed against shechitat simamim. I told you, this is one of the more difficult areas. It's going to challenge you. It really challenges what it means to be an Orthodox Jew, this particular area of halacha.
They had migraine headache.
You didn't say migraine. Would you say you'd have to lie down for a migraine?
People that I know that have migraine.
Okay.
Correct.
And you're a chol she'ein bo sakana, and then you could take things. And we're going to see there are other air times where you could take things as well. But, and we're also going to talk about the specifics. This is a very, very involved, detailed halacha. So I actually photocopied you all of the Shmir Shabbos Gilchasa on this chapter. It really is involved. And next week I'll bring you my bag of tricks. But today, it was really a level of introduction. So Gene asked a very, very difficult but very important question. Can you go back to the question you asked me a few minutes ago?
Remember?
Do you remember what it is?
Grinding.
Right, Gene said, nobody grinds today.
Okay.
When I have a pill, when I have a headache, I don't take out my powder of this and powder of that and take my mortar and pestle and mush them up. The last time I saw a mortar and pestle was on the CVS logo. Right? I haven't seen one since. Neither has a pharmacist.
There are things they do compound.
Really?
They do a mix.
They grind pills and they mix pills. Okay, fine. But then, but I went. Would that be permitted, by the way, on Shabbos to crush up a pill?
No, it's making small pieces.
But remember, are you allowed to permit something that's already been crushed? It's already been crushed. And now this probably no, because it's made into a new form. But if you had something that was only smushed together, I don't know how pills are made. Are pills made by pressure or made by baking?
No, but pressure.
So then, in theory, that would be permitted, ironically. But all right, in any case. But nobody grinds pills today. Nobody. I mean, nobody I know.
My mother in law does, but she's a pharmacist.
In her job as a pharmacist?
Sometimes.
As a pharmacist.
I mean, no, but nobody grinds. No, how did they used to do it in the old days?
Mortar and a pestle.
With what, though? What would they take? I mean, the old days. What would they take?
Take a mortar and a pestle.
And grind what?
Herbs.
Correct. You take herbs and leaves and things like that. And by the way, their medicine really worked. I mean, they say it worked. It probably wasn't the same medicine that we had, but what they have, whatever they knew, they say, what?
You live longer.
Well, that's an accurate statement.
Mm-hmm.
Because in total, let's say after we went from 1,000 to 120, after that,
mm-hmm.
In total, we live longer. In aggregate, we live longer. But if you were to add up the averages of the older people back then, they lived shorter for one very important reason, infant mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Infant mortality until the modern days was unbelievably high. So that means all the people that were born, a good number of them, a good chunk of them died at the age of 0, 1, or 2. But if you were to average in all the people that lived past the age of 10, their lifespan was considerably long. It wasn't very short. I think that's true. Anybody ever heard that? I might have just made that up. Okay. What?
Wasn't it really so long ago that the infant mortality was great?
Correct.
Last 100 years.
Right.
A century ago, you would find a family where a couple had 12 children.
Right.
Survived.
Correct. Correct. And that was just normal. That's just the way it was. Okay.
50 years ago, we had polio and
right, all these things. So now, what do you do though? But nobody grinds up herbs anymore to make medicines. So you say to the rabbi, it's wonderful that the rabbis made this gezeirah back then, even up to 100 years ago. But now that nobody does it anymore, forget it. Let's move on. Let me take my Tylenol and finish. Mm-hmm. My 2/3, I want my Tylenol and, you know, shalom al Yisrael, as we like to say. So how do we hold? Is that, can we say that or not? Can we not?
No.
No. Why? So turn to the second page. This is from the Rambam, Hilchos Mamrim. Mumar, what is a Mumar? Zin, what is a Mumar?
An
apostate, someone who abandons Judaism. But the Rambam, for some reason, felt it was important to include these in Hilchos Mamrim. Says the Rambam, Beitin Shigazu Zera, Otiknu Takana, a Beitin, a court, that made a decree or established an establishment. And they had a certain custom. And they spread this rule throughout all of Israel. And another Beit Din came later on and wanted to nullify the original Beit Din's decree. And they wanted to uproot that decree. The ota hagzera, the ota minhag, that practice or that custom. So what's the case, right? Nowadays we come together, we would say, you know, everybody can agree. There's no problem. Nobody's going to go grind their own stuff, right? Nobody here has a pharmaceutical company. The fourth line. Eino yachol ashiya gadol min harishonim bechachma ubiminyan. A Beit Din cannot nullify a previous Beit Din's decree. A court cannot nullify a previous court's decree unless it's bigger, greater in numbers, and wisdom.
But that's so subjective.
Correct.
I mean, numbers is not subjective.
Well, we'll see the numbers in a second. If the rabbis were smart enough and they were self-confident enough, they would have no problem doing it. It's not necessarily we're wiser. It's saying, you know, we're smart enough. I don't think that anybody would say, well, I'm smarter than, you know, Ravina and Ravashi. But they're saying that we have the sufficient wisdom, we're able to see, like I said, the whole picture, and we feel confident that we can nullify a decree, and we're not violated, we're the situation has changed, the times have changed, the status has changed, and that happens. In this case, it has happened. Okay? Hayah gadol b'chachma afit line. If it was greater in wisdom, avalo b'minyan, but not in numbers. B'minyan avalo b'chachma, with numbers, but not in wisdom. Eino yachol batel t'varach. And they know, they have to judge themselves. They cannot nullify the previous decree. Afilu, this is what Rambam says, he's very clear, it's very, very clear. Afilu batal hatam, shebiglalo gazu rishonim, ovitkino. Even if the reason they made that, they told you what the reason was. And they said, we're doing it, we're saying you can't do refuah on Shabbos, no healing on Shabbos, because we're afraid they're going to grind herbs. And that reason no longer applies. Says the Rambam, Ein ha'achronim yecholim levatel ad shehiyu gidolim mehem.
Okay.
The last ones may not nullify it until they're greater than the previous ones in Chachma and Minyan.
This also then refers to the date that you say you...
Detained Talamata, right. Similar issue.
Which doesn't make any sense anymore.
Right. We talked about this during the Between Months and Mara. Right. What he's saying is, when do we start saying Detained Talamatar in Shacharis and Shemoneh Esrei? December 5th, whatever it is. Why do we say December 5th? Anybody know? You want to be that's in the
people got back to Babel.
No, people got back to Babel. In Israel, they do it 2 weeks after Sukkot. That's when they do it in Israel. That's the right time. Cheshvan or something, right, in Israel. Why did you see the December 4th in the diaspora?
Because in Babel, the rainy season began later.
Correct. That was the rainy season in Babylonia.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll say, well, why don't I stop with the rainy season in Babylonia? So Gene said, this is the reason. Although, that's not a big deal. You can add in Betain Talamatar, in Shemoneh Esrei, one can pray for whatever one wants. If I'm a farmer and I need rain, you better believe I'm going to pray for rain. So I'm not limited. But here, I've got a headache. A mild headache, albeit, but a headache. It bothers me.
What if it's a migraine headache?
Oh, we talked about that. That's okay. We'll get to all those details. I got a mild headache. Why can't I take two Tylenol? Because way back 2,000 years ago, the rabbis were afraid that I was going to grind, sulfur root and mix it with talcum powder and come up with a headache, remedy. So our inclination is to say, and it's a really strong inclination, this doesn't make any sense at all. What's that? Yeah.
I just learned this week that there were tefanot made by Zugot in the Anshei Knesset Agadola.
Right.
One of the tefanot that they made was that all of the wheat from Mitzrayim was treif. It wasn't treif. It was tameh.
Why?
Because in order to keep the value of the wheat in Israel.
Right.
Okay, so they said that all the wheat that was coming from Alexandria wasn't tahor.
Right.
Does that still apply?
The Rambam writes, he writes, sometimes they made temporary or time-bound Zera. And they specifically said, I guess so. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head. I'm not familiar with that Zera. But I guess so.
And they also said there was another Zera that made a Zera that...
Also, you have to remember, if they didn't even keep it in their times, meaning they might have made it for a specific period of time, and once that situation had been alleviated, they might have gone back. I don't know how long it lasted for.
Okay.
Yeah, wait, let it be finished.
The other thing was that they made a Tatana that because of Antiochus coming into power and all the Jews were in really dire straits, they were in big trouble.
Right.
They thought about leaving Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the Tatanot was that they that all the other nations other than Israel was come to live. You can't live as chutzlar, in Chutzlar.
Well, I agree with that anyway, but okay. Okay, yeah, Gene.
What about the injunction against living in Egypt?
It's interesting. I mean, what do you do?
Rambam
clearly lives in Egypt. Right.
Rambam himself lived in Egypt.
Right.
As did billions of other Jews.
Yes. Well, I would say millions. I would say millions.
Well,
a number. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, what if you're born in Egypt? It's in the injunction to return to Egypt from Israel. But if you were born there, you have to leave? You have to emigrate?
Well, Rambam wasn't born in Egypt. He moved there.
He himself moved there?
He wasn't from Poland.
Later, he was born the same. That's right.
I
don't know. He never went to Eretz Yisrael. He never got to Eretz Yisrael. Only after he was dead, they buried him there. He never made it. I think he wanted to, but he was not allowed to by the government, by the caliph. I think. You'd have to ask a historian. Ask my wife. But anyway, I think this yeah.
You may have covered it before I came in late. But what if you're, as far as medication, you're taking a maintenance kind of medication?
We'll talk about all that. We haven't started that yet. Right? This is really just my way of introduction.
Okay.
And what this highlights, though, is, so he says, that's the end of the Rambam for our purposes. What it highlights is that Judaism, people like to think that Judaism is what God gave us in the Torah. Right? That's the definition of Judaism is. And the rabbis, they only had the ability to define. They didn't have the ability to really innovate. And that's really not true. Judaism is a rabbinic, a very strongly rabbinic-oriented religion. And the rabbis had the ability to innovate, they had the ability to define, but they had very much a great deal of power, as it were, to define the nature of the religion in a very real sense. And that if the rabbi said it in Efet HaKana, that's the halacha. You can't say, well, since the rabbi said it doesn't apply, if I violate it, I'm really not violating halacha. I'm really not violating. God said that whatever they say, that's what I want. And that's the way it works. And until we have the ability to repeal it, which I think we would do nowadays, you know, if all the rabbis got together and formed a Beit Din for the purpose, sole purpose of appealing, of repealing this this halacha of taking Tylenol on Shabbos, I think pretty much everybody would agree. You know, I don't know.
Same hold true. There was a gzera that chicken was kosher.
No. No, I think that they would keep that one.
No, but I mean, is that...
That's not a gzera. I think that's a definition. The Rabbanan, the rabbis defined... fowl as being fleshy.
Okay.
As well, that wasn't a gzera. That was more of a definition, I would say. You know, but for example, you know, there are many examples. You know, sometimes they felt, sometimes the rabbis decreed things that, for health purposes. So we know nowadays that it really isn't true. I mean, you know, who knows? You know.
Fish with chicken.
What?
Fish and
chicken together. Right, fish and meat together. Right, you know.
Right. That was one of the minhagei shtus or whatever, you know, that really people were keeping, but it specifically, when we were studying brachas, it was mentioned that it wasn't true that eating fish and meat.
So he used to have fish and meat together?
Yeah.
He used the same fork, same plate.
I'm
the same. Really?
The same
fork. Yeah. I don't know. It's pretty much brought down the Shulchan Aruch. I don't know.
He disbanded two forks at Kiddush.
It really made.
We're gonna have to revisit this at the ritual committee.
Seriously,
people had spent.
What?
It really like helped. What? Helped.
Do people not do that nowadays? Yeah. At your house, you serve, you use a different fork.
So do I.
Because
that's what we always did.
That's
what my grandmother did. What my grandmother did. We don't feel that we have to.
Okay. What? What's the bodhisattva?
Red Bendel.
That is a bodhisattva. Yeah. Yeah, he's right about that. Yeah,
okay.
Okay. A bodhisattva means idol worship. You know what a red bendel is? A red bendel, you know, if you go to Israel, go to the kotel, some old lady wants money, has these red strings that she ties around your wrist and tells you, now you're going to win the lottery here, or whatever one you want will happen to you. So, you know, when you're in Israel, you can for the year.
Around
babies, mm-hmm. wrists, and ankles, or whatever. And it was clear superstition.
Well, someone convinced, before I learned that with Rabbi Weil, someone, a rabbi's wife, convinced Harriet to sew a red thread in each one of the kids' underpants.
Underpants?
But it only worked if she said,
Now, if you bleached those underpants, which I hope you did, would that remove the aura?
So when okay. Had in Brachos, I was very happy.
So then you went through their underpants and removed it then, or they had already grown up by then?
They've grown up.
Yeah, okay.
But my sister-in-law, who's one of the granddaughters of Rabbi Breuer, I keep telling her that the red medal she's wearing is about a Zohar, and
she was very happy about that. No, people are very stuck on that. There were a lot of superstitions, especially in Eastern Europe. A lot of superstitious. Sephardic stuff too? The hand is a shiviti. That's an amulet. Yeah, but at least those have holy words in them.
Yes.
You know, I mean, at least there's something about God in there. No, but it's supposed to be a Kabbalistic form that has certain psukim and certain and the names of God in different ways. So this is God there. That's, you know, not idol worship. You know, idol worship. Okay, but what comes out from this, and, you know, I understand a certain level of unease with it, because on the one hand, the rabbis decreed it, and they read it for a reason, and now it no longer applies. On the other hand, though, the way the religion was built, the way God, you know, designed the religion, it's really a religion is in our hands. And there's a very famous story I'm going to recount, and people have a lot of problems with this story, and understandably so. There's a very famous story in Bava Metzia called the Tanur Shel Achnai. It was a certain kind of oven, and the rabbis were arguing about whether this oven, if one deconstructs it and reconstructs it, is it ritually impure or not. I mean, it's really some, you know, very esoteric discussion. So there's a machloka between all the rabbis in the Beis Medrash. So we're all sitting around the study hall yelling at each other. All the rabbis in the Beis Medrash and Rabbi Eliezer. Am I right, Herschel? Rabbi Eliezer? I don't remember. I think it was Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Eliezer said, I'm sure I'm right. I know I'm right. They said, no, you're not right. So he said, if I'm right... What did he say? If I'm right, I think, get a few of them. If I'm right, the stream that runs by this study hall will reverse itself and start going the other way. Says the Talmud, that's exactly what happened. Because if I'm right, you know, this tree will uproot itself and plant itself on the other side of the field.
It will be about this whole machlokas, the tree.
Right, because that's where it was. Okay. Right? And what happened? The tree, zoop, well, the Talmud says, one place to the other. He says, if I'm right, the walls of the Beit Midrash, the walls of the study hall, will cave in. I don't know, he was there, I don't know what he was thinking. But anyway, so, you know, it starts caving in. The rabbi said, walls, stop, because it's not your jurisdiction. And the walls, they said the walls stopped halfway. They're halfway in and halfway out. He said, if I'm right, a voice will come down from heaven and say that I'm correct. Halacha is like me. Lo and behold, he's right. This is going. And the rabbi said, sorry.
We don't justify a basko.
Right. But we don't make halacha based on a basko. Basko means a voice from heaven. You know, that's not how we decide halacha. We are the majority, he is in the minority, and even though God himself agrees with Rabbi Eliezer, the halacha is like us.
Pushing it.
So then the story ends that one day one of the rabbis was walking around and he met Eliyahu Hanabi. And the rabbi said to Eliyahu Hanabi, you know, hey, was God listening that day? He said, yeah, God was listening. He said, what did God say? He said, in the language of the Gemara says, Nitzchuni banai nitzchuni. That my sons, they beat me. They win.
Say that again.
Nitzchuni banai nitzchuni. That my sons, the Rabbanon, were correct.
Well,
that Akash Baruch Hu gave us the power of the Torah. And you wonder why we got it so carefully. You know, us crazy rabbis. And how it's very, very, you can't be cavalier about it at all. And that the power of defining the Torah is really in the hands of the rabbis who we trust. So that's why, you know, we choose our gedolim very, 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 very carefully. Because they have the ability to turn things upside down. Look, for example, at Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein had the ability to take a woman who was married and make her not married. Take a woman whose husband died in the Holocaust and interpret it in such a way that she was no longer married. How could he do that? Because he had earned the trust of the Jewish people. And he could really turn things on its head if he wanted to, because he knew the whole system, and when we trusted him with the system, right. So that's why, can I tell the story?
Sure.
You know, unfortunately, Jeff's sister had perhaps one of the worst things that could possibly happen in Jewish law. Her husband, were convinced, committed suicide, but there's no evidence of it. So they think that he jumped into Niagara River and went over the falls. But there's no evidence of it. And yeah, and this is one of those situations, yeah, 2 years ago, this is one of those situations in which the Gemara says, since the water is Mayim She'ein Behem Sof, it's no and not ending water, so he could have come on the other side and nobody would know. He could have been living in Barbados for all we know. He went off the deep end, decided that I have enough of this life, and I want to live somewhere else. And believe me, in Jewish history, it's happened before. The guy jumped in the water and came out the other side, and lo and behold, he's living in, you know, Guatemala and living the good life. So in this case, it's very, very, very difficult to be Mate Aguna.
But there was Rabbi Womark, who used to be here in Detroit, is, you know, he said any day she's going to have Sat Halacha that will be recognized.
So how are they doing it? How are they doing it?
Limitation of time?
No, mm-hmm. Absolutely not.
No,
not for Aguna. They're not getting out of it by Aguna. What are they going to do? They're trying to nullify her wedding.
But
aren't they?
But no, because now they're saying that the kids will have to say Kaddish and everything.
Really?
I don't know. I've not spoken to him.
I don't know the vagaries of it, but you could understand why,
how they would do it.
I don't know. I'm not making judgments at all. But you can understand just how, you know, if you go to somebody who doesn't have the trust of the Jewish people, he could tell some woman, you're no longer married anymore, you never were married anymore, and she'll go get married, and she'll be in big trouble, and her children will be up the creek.
There was a case where the Israeli sub, Dakar, was lost.
Right.
After some time, the Rabbanut said to the surviving family,
right, then you can
Able starts now.
Correct, right.
On what basis?
I don't know. I remember all this stuff came up in 9/11. You know, we had extensive discussions in 9/11. How do you decide what evidence is good enough? But, you have to have trust. You have to have faith in these people. And they have to guard it very carefully because, you see, it's not that they have the power to interpret. They have the power to legislate. So you'll say, okay, why don't we go to get together now? And if everybody would agree that medicine is not a problem anymore, grinding, so why don't we all get together and make this base in? Anybody want to answer that question? Why don't we all get this base in together and make this, panim, this court, and we nullify
it? Not everybody agrees you should do it.
It seems today that nobody wants to go against the status quo. I hear this in my own home all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, what do we need this gazera, anymore for?
Right.
And I don't necessarily have the wherewithal.
No, what I'm saying to you is, even if we don't need it, and we all acknowledge that we don't need it, it's still binding. It's still part of the Jewish religion. But what I'm asking you is, why don't the rabbis get together? Mm-hmm. Why don't they solve the problem? You know what the answer is?
They can't get together.
What?
Because as the generations go down, they get weaker.
Well, that's clearly not a problem, because the Rambam, there is a provision for revising the Takanot. They say after a greater b'chachma. Obviously there were times when a Beit Din would get together and say, we feel we have the authority to make this decision. Sometimes maybe the b'chachma could mean we have more information than they had. Mm-hmm. We're able to elucidate. We can shed light on the situation. Nowadays with technology, as we're going to see in the laws of refuah and the laws of healing, very often, the Gemara will say there's a malady that isn't a malady today, that we're not worried about it today. And the Gemara will say you have to rush the person to the hospital. But, nowadays, the doctor lets you sit in his office for a few hours. Yeah, with that, and then, no, let me finish my thought. The reason why we don't convene a Beit Din is, welcome to the Gullus.
What?
Welcome to Gullus. That is the situation of the Jews in exile. There's no unified anything in Judaism today.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line. We can't agree on,
Is that why some of the Tfilot are different in Israel than they are in Gullus?
What do you mean? No, that's customary.
The last bracha before Shmoneh Esrei.
Right, they don't say the whole bracha from the Olam. But that's because of the Sephardic custom. That's because Israel, by and large, adopted Sephardic custom and it really spread. That's more based on custom, not based on takanot.
Okay.
Here we're talking about established halachic takanot. And in order to reverse them, you need unity. When do you get unity?
When
Mashiach comes. Right? So you think we want Mashiach to come because life is going to be better. But the religion will change. Right? The religion will change very much so. And it will want to change. One of the problems of being in the Gola, of being in exile, is it's static and we're sort of locked in. And we don't have the ability because we don't have that unity. We don't have that togetherness. So could we do it? In theory, we could. But in practice, it never works.
Another consequence of Gola, that in Israel, for the first time in centuries, the Rabbanut has to deal with a political entity.
Has to deal with?
A political entity of which they were deciding part.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the relationship between Knesset and Knesset,
right,
which is a reality that doesn't exist outside of Israel.
You mean the church and state kind of dynamic?
The Knesset of the synagogue and the Knesset of the Israeli parliament.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and the real question is, who has the real power?
In some instances...
The rabbis don't really. They only have the power that the government gives them.
Yep.
And rabbinic Judaism doesn't work that way. The Sanhedrin was also the legislative arm. Mm-hmm. So they had the power to enact, because their enactments were legislative. They weren't just religious enactments. They were all types of enactments. And they were working in concert with the Melech, with the king, with the government. The government was working hand in hand, ideally, with the Sanhedrin. They worked together.
So there's no separation between government and...
No, not in the Jewish religion. No, not in the Jewish government.
Like here, there's a separation of...
Correct. In America, it's the best thing for us, the very best thing. But in Israel, for the Jewish people, you can see what happens. What happens to the Jewish people in America? It's the best thing for Jews. It's the worst thing for Jews. And that all depends on your perspective.
What you were saying before about the bat mitzvah and Eliyahu HaNavi story, the follow up for that. What Hashem said was that the people over
they had the right to overrule God.
Now, so that's when you go to a rav and you go to a beis din or there was some kind of sakana.
Right.
No matter what God originally intended, if they tell you something and
what does that mean? What God? See, the idea of, well, this can't be what God originally intended. I don't know what that means.
What I'm saying is, if you go and you ask the Shaila,
mm-hmm.
okay, it says something and it's not very clear.
Right.
And you go to somebody you trust, someone that the community trusts. Who's to say that the answer you're getting is what God wants you to do? Is it because, are we?
I always wonder.
Is it
meaning,
saying that Hashem
if it's, yes, without a doubt,
today,
without a doubt,
right,
God imbued in the Jewish people unbelievable power. Let me give you the best example of that. The best example was the Jewish calendar. Right? Who determined what day was Yom Kippur?
Sanhedrin.
We did. How come, you know, God didn't give us a calendar to establish it? Because God said, it's yours, run with it. And I think we've done a pretty good job, by and large. I mean, we fight amongst ourselves. But they did a pretty good job keeping the covenant. They knew what they were doing. You know, and they had insight into what would maintain Judaism. So I think the answer to your question is, yeah, God wants whatever your rabbi's going to tell you. That's what God wants. It's not that God said, I want him to say this. Oh, I wish he had said that. You know, when you go to a rabbi and ask a shayla, and the rabbi's giving an honest answer and an objectively correct answer. So obviously there are divergent opinions. So he has to use what he calls his shikul hadas, his knowledge and his experience, and his also his temperament, as it were, and uses all of those things put together in order to come up with an answer for you, for your specific situation. So the answer that he gives you is what God wants for you.
Okay, so then if I go ahead and follow what that person I trusted said,
yes,
I can be sure that I didn't do the wrong thing.
Without a doubt, I think with great confidence.
Well, I've been doing wrong.
There you go.
So I'm pleased.
You know what I'm saying? So, and let's say I tell you, well, and I tell you you should do something else, or this is not permitted, and you thought that it was permitted, and a rabbi told you that. So clearly, by the way, it's just a difference of opinion. He's not going to tell you something that's usher according to everybody. You understand what I'm saying? What?
There's almost no such thing.
Almost, correct. That's exactly the point.
Almost. The story about me, two women go in.
No rabbi would ever tell you to drive to show on Shabbos. Yeah.
No Orthodox rabbi would.
Ever.
No.
Never, ever.
No,
right?
Orthodox rabbis tell you you can't touch a newspaper.
That's not true.
Okay.
The ones tell you you
what,
can't.
What if there's a, doctor that's in the shul and you need to go see that doctor, life and death? I can drive to shul that day.
Okay, correct.
Okay, so that's what I mean. Like,
correct.
Basically, there's no way. It's very static. There's really no way to say
it. It's not very dynamic. Correct. It's not. But isn't that the beauty of it? I mean, to be honest with you, that's why it's called the Torah Shebaal Peh. It was never meant to be written down, and it was a very big assessment to write it down. Because as soon as you write it down, I'm locked into what this book says. It was never meant to be locked in. It was meant to be passed from generation to generation and to be interpreted and applied. And that would be the halacha.
However, this.
What?
They say that you can't change it.
Correct.
Unless there's a really good, strong reason.
Correct. They have the right to change it. Meaning, you better respect what that Beit Din say, and you better know your stuff. And you better have have every piece of information, and then we give you the right to change it. So there is that flexibility. So nowadays, though, I can't come along and say, I don't have the right, I don't have the ability to come along and say, well, you know, it really doesn't apply anywhere, do what you want. Because I believe in the process, I believe in the power that the Rabbanim had. And once they have the ability to make that takana, that is God's will, and I don't have the right to change it. Yeah?
On the other hand, you say about writing down. One of the great things of Rav Moshe was that he put everything down in Igros Moshe.
Right.
I know other poskim whose opinion was they wouldn't write it down, and they gave just as many Piskei Torah.
Right.
Because they felt that it was for that person at that particular time.
Correct.
Those particular circumstances that more aren't necessarily the same as would be.
Every time you write something down, there's a benefit and a pitfall. Right. Rav Soloveitchik never wrote down. The Rav never wrote his tracking down. Never.
Right.
For that reason. You know? So what happens though when you're left to the generation that no longer has the Rav Moshe Feinstein? You know, we talk about who are the Gedolim today? Who's the Gadol? Who's the Gadol Hadar today? So 20 years ago, everybody would have said Rav Moshe, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. They would have said that. Rav Soloveitchik. Who's the Gadol Hadar today? Rav El Yashiv. They all go to Rav El Yashiv today. Okay. Who is there a Gadol Hador in America today? I don't know people who go to the Never Miskei Rebbe for Shilas. I mean, he's a great Torah scholar and sage, but I don't, you know. They don't remember the Never. What?
The Cleveland
Rebbe. You know what I'm saying? You're grasping at straws.
There's
no, you know, it's a real, it's a problem. It's a real, real problem when there's no universally recognized, you know, leader.
One of the reasons is because some people think it's been written down and everything that could be.
Clearly, they're going down. It's bad. You know, it's not the way it used to be. Okay. I want to read for you. This is actually a book called the Mishnas Avraham, written by a man named Avraham Sofer Avraham. He is not a rabbi. He's a doctor. He's alive today. And he wrote on the top the Sutras of Shulchan Aruch. And on the bottom are all the psakim, all the different halachic aspects of things that he writes based on the Shulchan Aruch in that specific area. So usually when I have a shayla, when it comes to medicine, the first place I look is right here. Because he really is unbelievable. And, you know, it just amazes me the thing that a layman can do. Every rabbi uses his book. You know, really, it's you know, very authoritative.
He's a pirate, right?
What?
He's authoritative.
Is he a pirate?
I'm asking you.
I don't think so. I think he was asking Isaac. His name was Dr. Abraham S. Abraham. And he gives lectures every now and then also. You know, I don't know if he's a good speaker, but he's a really good writer. Okay, so like I said lesson before, it's really, really long. And I don't want to overwhelm you. I was afraid I would. Okay. Okay. Skip to line 7. Katabak Sota Choshen. Sota Choshen lived in the 1700s. Mirel Omar, it seems to me, the Isur Refuah Mishum Gezerat Shechikat Simanim, the violation of Refuah, the prohibition of Refuah because of this problem of you grinding, Kiel Tfei Bizmanenu. It's in force, but it's Kiel Tfei, it's lighter, it's less stringent. Why? Kevan Shechav Ein Bikiin Bishchikat Simanim, since nobody knows how to grind stuff, Vahar Refuot Naaseh Ayidei HaRochkin Beit HaMirkachar, and the healing is done. Who does the grinding? The pharmacist at the pharmacy. So therefore, lo sayach l'migzar dil ma'ati l'shchikat simanim. It's not relevant to make that gezeira, to make that decree. I'm going to skip that line. He gives a proof. Let's get to the end of line 10.
Does this imply that the grinding was done by the individual?
At the time of the Gemara, yes.
Yes.
If you got sick, you didn't go to the pharmacist. You went, right, there wasn't. You ground it yourself. Okay, and by the way, why didn't you grind it beforehand?
It's just for it.
What? Yeah, it was not potent. It's like any good spice.
It wasn't.
Right, lost the potency. So you wouldn't grind it before.
He seems to be contradicting everything that you said.
No, he said, Kiel Tfei. You were going to apply it. It's there. But one can be more lenient in areas of, you know, for example, they say, and this is true, this is possible. Let's say a person doesn't know, am I kogufo or not? People very often, especially when it comes to halacha, they tend to be more machmir on themselves. Oh, I don't know. Am I really sick or am I not sick? You know what I'm saying? So a person of human nature, you know, religious people of human nature sometimes just say, I must not be sick enough. So he says, in that instance, a person should be more makil, should be more lenient. And even if you don't know, if you are in doubt, then you can treat yourself as if you really are sick. Because this gzera is in less force. So they take that, you have to take it into consideration. Not that it doesn't apply, but you take the idea that the reason it doesn't apply into consideration. Let's skip a little bit. Okay. Okay, skip to line 15. The Siyem Sham, this is in the Torah Chesed of the Gaon of Lublin. He concludes in the Torah Chesed. The Zeh Lashon Ha'od, three lines on the end of the word in line 15. Va'ata, now, Mi me'itanu ya'iz bida'ato. Who would have that much ya'iz, that much, help me out here, Gene.
Dare,
thank you. Lisko b'flash shichlo, ezek zeirah chashiv hatam yadua, shelo yitztarech minyan acher lahatiro. Who in his right mind can say, you know, I know to such a degree, I know so important, so much, that I don't think that this degree applies anymore, and therefore I'm not going to apply it. Ve'ein lanu ela ha'dvarim mufurashim b'divrei ha'rishonim shatam yadua. All we have is what our sages told us. And the only time we allow the gzera is when the reason no longer applies at all. Meaning, I don't have the guts to say that the reason doesn't apply anymore. Does any of you have the guts to say it? So I can't say that it applies anymore. Okay? I'd come to show no. Now, by the way, Rabbi Zagrabel, Moshe Feinstein, he did at times say this. Sometimes there were gzera where he said, you don't have to apply it. Can somebody give me a good example? Good, very good. Chalav Yisrael. The Moshe Feinstein, Chalav Yisrael is Zerah of Durabana from the times of the Talmud. So Moshe Feinstein, he didn't come along and say there's no Chalav Yisrael and no Zerah anymore. He said that all milk that's produced in America has the status of Chalav Yisrael. So he could have done that about medicine, could he have not? Easily he could have done it, and everybody would take Tylenol today for a light headache. But he did not. So obviously, he felt that it wasn't warranted. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to realize. Well, the Sidra Rav, and the Ksara Shoshan Choshen continues, line 17, 18, I think. Gan Isur Refuah B'Shabbat, even the Isur of Refuah, Yesh Lomar, we could say, De'ein Tam Yadu Asa Asu Mishun Chivak Shemanim. It's not just the reason. I mean, the rabbis did things don't be so cavalier about the reasons. An individual shouldn't be so cavalier about allowing it. They told you the reason, but you still need another minyan, you need another bakin in order to annul it. Okay? He said, umikol makam, nonetheless, the issue topic was that, he said, this is, now we're now 150 years after the Ksos HaKoshen. The Bizman Hazeh, nowadays, ein bikir b'chigat shimamnim, batel ha'isr mimela, it should be that there's no prohibition at all. The Afagav, unless he says, she'ein lana bikir b'chigat shimamnim, even though we don't know how to do it, ava yesh lomar, some could say, shenim se'im b'komod ba'olam, there are places in the world, she'adayin ma'aseh avotem b'yadehem, they still do it in some places of the world, batel b'suot b'tiyot shvesol chakim b'asman ha'simamnim. Are there any places in the world, to your knowledge, that they still grind stuff? Anybody know?
Peru, Africa,
they probably do it. Any Jews? Anywhere Jews are living? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Okay. So he says, therefore, the Gzeira is still in its place. The Tzitzel Eliezer, he says, if you look at line 24, the Kenkat of Tzitzel Eliezer, the Tzitzel Eliezer wasn't 150 years ago. The Tzitzel Eliezer was of Waldenburg. Anybody know when he lived?
Who?
The Tzitzel Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenburg. What? Still alive? He's alive today, still writing. Yeah, he's an old man, still writing today. Okay. He says, the Ra'ah Gam Pitei Tshuva, line 24, Shekotei V'shem Yeshua Yaakov, Shedavar Shaya V'chlal Gzeira, Av Shebatal HaTam Eino Chozer LeHeter. Even though the reason is gone, we can't allow it, we cannot permit it. And et cetera, et cetera. You can read the rest of it. He says, we don't have the ability. We don't have the right to annul it. So therefore, now next week we're going to get into the nitty gritty. We're going to get into Tylenol and ointments and showers and sprays and massages and all those specifics.
Ointments are
some are more liquidy. Some are more liquidy. And we'll see oil and applying diaper ointments and all kinds of different things. So you're going to say this is all a gzera of a gzera that no longer applies. The answer is yes. You are absolutely correct, but it's still in force. It is still a halacha. It is the normative halacha, and you have to treat it as such. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, that is the test of what orthodoxy is all about: having what we call emunat chachamim, faith in, and also the understanding of the privileges of and the rights that chachamim had to establish and shape the Jewish religion. And that really is what defines orthodoxy today: the trust in the chachamim, the faith in them, and also the adherence to them. That's what makes orthodoxy as strong as it is today. See you next week.